Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joseph Fink. I'm the President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, California, and the past Chairman of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And this evening, I'm the moderator of the program. Tonight's program is also part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, which is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to our speaker this evening, John Meacham. Mr. Meacham is an author, a journalist, and an editor. He is not just any author, but a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and the executive editor and executive vice president at Random House. He is also a contributing editor to Time Magazine, editor-at-large at WNET, and a commentator on a variety of news and cultural programs. He is the former co-anchor of the public affairs broadcast Need to Know on PBS and the former editor of Newsweek. His latest book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, was just published a few weeks ago. He's also well known for another book on an American president, The American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, which was published in 2008 and for which he received the Pulitzer Prize. He's also the author of two other New York Times bestsellers, The American Gospel, God, Founding Fathers, and the Making of the Nation, and Franklin and Winston, an intimate portrait of the epic friendship about the wartime relationship between Roosevelt and Churchill. That book was named Book of the Year by the Los Angeles Times. He's a member of the Society of American Historians. He serves on the Board of Trustees of the Churchill Center. He's on the board of the National Advisory Council of the John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis, and on the Advisory Committee on the Center of the Constitution at James Madison's Montpellier. Before he leaves, I'll probably ask him to be a member of my board as well. Mr. Meacham is also, as a journalist, has written for the New York Times, the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, Slate, and the Los Angeles Times Book Review, among many, many, many others. He was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, educated at the University of South Tennessee, where he received a degree of summa cum laude, and is the holder now of 6 honorary degrees. Please welcome John Meacham.
I love this. Thank you, Dr. Fink. I'm enormously gratified. It's all downhill from here after that generous introduction. A couple of points quickly. One is, for those of you who may not have heard of the University of the South, and there may be one or two, it's kind of a combination of Brideshead Revisited and Deliverance. And so it's an Episcopal institution in rural Tennessee. The other important thing to raise about my board service, which is spotty at best, I must say, is I was, for a brief time, I was on 2 vestries at 2 Episcopal churches in New York, which is the lay board of directors, St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, where we went to church, and Trinity Church Wall Street downtown. And we have young children, and the vestry meetings were always early in the morning. And I have discovered since then that children require care in the mornings, which was not made totally clear early on. So I would go off in the mornings to these meetings, which for me was kind of like interactive trollop, you know, just good fun. And my wife, I think perhaps offering some a slightly critical tone about my record of not being around for getting everybody dressed and going off to vestry meetings, called her mother. And my Mississippi mother-in-law won my heart forever by saying, "Oh, honey, if y'all live down here, he'd just be at deer camp." So if you need me, I'm there. I want to start. It's 1790. We're in New York, the nascent capital of a nascent republic. Thomas Jefferson has returned from France to become the first Secretary of State. Alexander Hamilton, an illegitimate child from Nevis, is the Secretary of the Treasury, and they hate each other. And they are at each other's throats. They are, as Jefferson put it, daily pitted as two cocks in the cabinet, always at war, over the direction of the country. Everything's at stake. Democracies did not have a very good record before this, and it, from day to day, we weren't sure it was going to have a much better one. George Washington, the president, becomes annoyed by his two lieutenants being so brutal to one another, and writes the following letter to both men. "How unfortunate that whilst we are encompassed on all sides with avowed enemies and insidious friends, that internal dissensions should be harrowing and tearing our vitals." Harrowing and tearing our vitals. It's a remarkable phrase from Washington. For one thing, it's memorable, which is not a big thing for Washington. And it goes to, I think, the emotional content and the political strife of that particular hour. Here's how well it worked. This is what Jefferson wrote back. "I will not suffer the slanders of a man, Hamilton, whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country, which has not only received him and given him bread, but heaped its honors on his head." So that Dr. Phil intervention was not wildly successful. Hamilton said that Jefferson was an atheist in religion and a fanatic in politics. And an anonymous letter writer wrote to Jefferson in these days, "I think you ought to get a damn kicking, you redheaded son of a bitch." So I know Karl Rove wants to think he invented all of this, but we've been dealing with it for a while. These are perennial forces of partisanship and division, argument, sometimes good-willed, sometimes not so good-willed. There are perennial forces. They shape us. They shaped us then. They shape us now. But in particular lives, they play themselves out in a way that I think is illuminating for us. I know it's entertaining for me because I'm, well, a practicing dork, as you just heard. And so I believe deeply in the utility of biography, not only to inspire us, but because these stories are about flawed and difficult and often sinful, incomplete, imperfect people, I believe that makes them more accessible as opposed to less, and more worth our consideration as opposed to less. I don't think we should consign anyone in terms of history beyond the pale of consideration and revisitation because of their flaws. To me, the flaws are what make them fascinating because, I don't know about you all, but I have a few, and I like to think that within my own soul, there is the battle between light and dark. Light wins most of the time, at least 51% of the time. And so I leave that to others to judge whether it does or not. But the point of biography for me is to look back and take figures from the past all in all. And I think I learn more from sinners than I do from saints. And I think that a lot of folks are like that. So why does the particular life of Thomas Jefferson bring us all out at this particular hour? Is it because he was a partisan and we also live in a partisan age? Is it because he was a figure of great political skill in an age where we feel we need it? I think those are some reasons. I think the central reason that from decade to decade and age to age, Jefferson resonates is because he represents the best of us and the worst of us all at once. He articulated an ideal of human freedom. He made a, as Dr. King later said, he wrote the promissory note of American liberty and then woefully failed to bring it fully into being. I don't know about you all, but I woefully fail all the time. And I think that taking him as a whole person, as a human being, as a man, not a monument, is absolutely essential. And it will, and it teaches us, I think, that when we are confronted with seemingly insuperable obstacles and we are led by leaders with huge blind spots and faults, that we should not give up hope that we can get over these obstacles, because what seemed insuperable then and the leaders who were flawed then did get us over these obstacles. And so, as Winston Churchill once said, the future is unknowable, but the past should give us hope. And I think that's true. So let's talk about the best and talk about the worst in Jefferson. The best is he was living and working in one of the most exciting eras in human history. Princely and priestly authority was giving way. For the first time, individuals were being trusted with their own intellectual and political destinies. Suddenly, there was a sense that monarchs did not have a direct line to God, and therefore everyone else had to bow down before the monarch as the agent of a divine will. He was trying as hard as he could, Jefferson was, to take those Enlightenment ideals and give them political form. In many, many ways, I think that's what the American Revolution was about. It was about taking ideas of human liberty, ideas about human destiny, and creating a political context in which we could pursue those. There was a phrase somewhere about the pursuit of happiness. I can't remember where it was, but pursuing happiness, this was not something they were casting off as propaganda or to fill a particular political moment. This was a deeply felt, well thought out, I believe, project. And what Jefferson believed was that without a sound political foundation, the work of the Enlightenment would fall apart. And guess who would come back? Kings and priests and bishops. And authority would be restored, authoritarianism would be restored, as opposed to the experiment in self-government succeeding from generation to generation. For Jefferson, and this is very hard for us now, I think, to get this through our heads, at least it's hard for me, the life of the mind and the political life were inextricably linked. They were contiguous regions with porous borders. Because if you didn't share an enlightened view of the world in which the life of the mind, the capacity of an individual to seek out discoveries, to learn, to put reason in the place of revelation, if you didn't believe in that, then you couldn't be part of a republic based on individual dignity and individual worth. So the issue for Jefferson always was, how do you preserve the role of reason in a practical way in a world that is hopelessly complicated and we are all driven by ambitions and appetites that are unreasonable? Jefferson's answer to that was, you create a system of self-government in which we care enough about each other to believe that our fates are linked. We don't have to love each other. This is not a kumbaya kind of thing, and I apologize. I'm in California. I know we're supposed to love each other. But I'm a Southerner. We've proven we don't. There's a movie out about that with cell phones going off, apparently. But if we don't believe that we're linked, if we don't believe that we're connected one to another, if we don't believe that John Donne was right, that no man is an island, then we will never make the mutual concessions of opinion, the mutual sacrifice of opinion, necessary to make a democracy and a republic work. If we are all atomized, if we all just simply pursue our own ambitions and appetites, then there is no democracy because there's no reason to compromise. There's no reason to give up something there's no reason for me to give up something so that you can do well. Because my hope would be that someday you'll do that for me. That's the Republican covenant. And that's what Jefferson was trying to bring into being. And it's why he saw the life of the mind and the life of science and reason as intimately connected. Because if we weren't doing that, then we were heading on a road toward absolutism and the return of a king, probably a British king, possibly a younger Prussian brother. Jefferson was very worried about younger brothers of Frederick the Great who were sort of shopping for a country. That was a defining struggle for this generation. I argue in the book that we can't really understand this period without seeing the period between 1763 and 1815 as a 50-year war between Great Britain and the United States, the end of the French and Indian War and the end of 1812. It was as consuming a drama, I believe, in the imaginations and daily lives, political lives of the people of that time, as the Cold War was to people from Truman to George H.W. Bush. Sometimes the war was hot, sometimes it was cold, sometimes it was implicit, sometimes explicit, sometimes it had foreign policy implications, sometimes it had domestic political implications, but it was always there. So imagine trying to read a history of post-war America without reference to the Cold War. I believe that the struggle against Britain was that important to Jefferson and Madison. Washington, Hamilton, Adams took a softer view of it, but that was the defining, in many ways, the defining difference between those two camps. Jefferson worried all the time, until the day he died, that a British king was going to come back, that the American experiment was going to go the way of Rome, that there would be a Caesar or a Bonaparte. That was his phrase, a Caesar or a Bonaparte was going to come. And why wouldn't he believe that, given the history of the world? And so my view of Jefferson is that he was an eminently practical and pragmatic politician who had this highly enlightened, fascinating to me, view of the world. And in combining those two things, in being able to think about what a republic would require to survive, and then being able to cut deals, pass laws, write declarations, win elections, to create a context in which those ideas could thrive and that republic could survive, is his great gift. The fact that he could do both. That's my definition of the art of power in this book, is that many politicians, many people, can project a vision of the ideal. They can paint a great portrait of where we have to go. There are a lot of people who are very good legislative mechanics. They're great fixers. You can send them in, get a deal done, and you're finished for that session. It is a very rare person who can do both. And our greatest political leaders in American history have been like that. Franklin Roosevelt was like that. Abraham Lincoln was like that. Ronald Reagan was like that. Lyndon Johnson was like that. But it's a very few number of people. And Jefferson was, I believe, the first. I think he was a better politician. He was a more successful politician than Washington and far more successful than Adams. And by the way, that drove John Adams crazy. And Abigail even more so. One of my many character flaws is that I like politicians. I like people who go into the arena and fight the good fight. And even if it's a bad fight, at least they're there and they have the opportunity to possibly do good because they're there, they're in the arena, and they've taken the responsibility. Now, to whom much is given, much is expected. I don't think you elect them and then somehow know that they're immune from criticism or our demands. Quite the opposite. The Jeffersonian vision of politics was that you had to be committed to some principle. It kind of didn't matter what it was. In Jefferson's case, it was the survival and success of American liberty. He would do anything short of compromising the existence of the nation. It was that driving a reality for him. Worried all the time. I cannot tell you the letters on and on about monarchists among us, the British influence, just letter after letter, day after day. And the wonderful thing about this argument is that the British did come back. And so he wins. Jefferson wins the argument because of 1812. They were back. They burned the White House. They lost two. How they managed to lose twice to us, I don't know. I'm delighted. But, you know, I say to my British friends, you know, once you pay back Lend-Lease, I want you to explain exactly how this happened. And it upsets them, which is why I do it. They came back. And so the work of Jefferson's days was to create this republic that could withstand any storm, including a returning British storm. And that, I think, is in large measure part of the best part of Jefferson, is he believed deeply enough in the promise of America that he had articulated, that he wanted us, he wanted successive generations to be able to live in the light of that achievement. He and Adams talked about the American Revolution as if it were their adopted child. It was an organic thing to them. It was a person. They had cared for it. They'd birthed it. They'd nurtured it. I can go with this metaphor all day. They saw it into an unruly adolescence, on and on. But they spoke of it with a kind of reverence and a kind of sweetness, if you will, that I think underscores the depth of the commitment to the system that they set in motion. They disagreed about almost everything else. They disagreed about the form of government. They disagreed about the specifics. They disagreed about slavery. They disagreed a lot. But fundamentally, what brought them back together again after their break in the 1790s was a common love. And that's not too strong a word. St. Augustine defined a nation as a collection of people bound together by a common object of love. A nation is a collection of people bound together by a common object of love. So what we always have to ask ourselves, it seems to me, as we test ourselves in the storms of history, is what do we love in common? And what John Adams and Thomas Jefferson loved in common was America, as they had roughly conceived it and set it off into the world. So that's the best of us. That's Jefferson saying, I have seen the march of civilization coming like a cloud of light across the seacoast and through the continent, and where it stops, no one will know. No one will know. Wonderful stuff. We can quote him all day. He is the president most given to eloquent needlepoint pillows. However, he also represents the worst of us, because he lived with a central hypocrisy. And the great American tragedy was his tragedy, which was an inability to apply the political skills that I've described and that I believe were formidable to the resolution of America's original sin, which was African and then African-American slavery. There's no getting around it. There's no excusing it. There's some explaining it, and we'll do that. But he's not only indicted before the bar of history on this, he's convicted. And what I think is important about understanding how he got to that place, how he got to a place where he gave up, which was a very un-Jeffersonian thing to do. He almost never gave up on anything. But he did give up on slavery after 1784, very early in his career. He was first elected to office in 1769 as a 25-year-old, almost 26-year-old member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia. He served until 1809 as president. In between, he was a legislator of Virginia, a member of the Continental Congress, the Confederation Congress. He was the American Minister to France, the Secretary of State, the Vice President, and the President of the United States. He had some access to the halls of power. He was the hall of power in many cases. And yet, after 1784, at a time when he was a member of the Confederation Congress, he never really tried to do anything about slavery. As a young man, as a lawyer and a legislator, he tried on three or four occasions, maybe five, to reform the institution, to take steps that would have ameliorated it somewhat. And he lost publicly and decisively each time. And there are two things that politicians hate more than anything else, and that is losing publicly and decisively. And so he gave up. His own life was totally suffused and made possible by slavery. His first memory was of being a child on a pillow being handed up to a slave on horseback to be taken on a family journey. One of the last things we know that happened to him was he was in his alcove bed at Monticello, and he was uncomfortable, and he couldn't get comfortable, and he's trying to signal to his white family what to do. And no one understands except an enslaved butler who totally gets it, shifts the pillow, and Thomas Jefferson is comfortable again. So from the beginning to the end of his life, it was made possible by slavery and its attendant implications, both economic and cultural and political. So why did he give up? He didn't like losing, and he couldn't see past his own issues of convenience, his own need for the order that had made his life possible. It's a painful thing to talk about. His children with Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman with whom he began having a sexual liaison in Paris in the late 1780s. She struck what I call the Treaty of Paris in the book, in an enormously courageous moment. She took what was one of the worst hands that could be dealt a human being, which was to be a woman enslaved in Virginia in the 18th century. Thomas Jefferson, by the way, had one of the best hands that could be dealt you, to be a white slave owner, Virginian landowner. He had the best, she had the worst, and she defeated him in a negotiation. She said, I will only go back to Virginia with you if any children of, if we have any children, if they are freed by the time they're 21. Of all the moments I would like to have some film of Jefferson's face, that's the one. Because it was his whole world turned upside down. No one negotiated with Thomas Jefferson. No one. He was born to command. He was the eldest son of a landowning, landholding planter family in Virginia. His life was about deference to him. His life was about the acquisition and wielding of power, both in his own world and in the broader world. And here is this teenage woman, girl, young woman, saying, laying out to him the terms on which she will let him have his desires. It's an enormously courageous moment, I think, for Sally Hemings, and something that is less appreciated in this story than I think it should be more appreciated. Sally Hemings was, by the way, Thomas Jefferson's wife's half sister, showing the complications of life in Virginia. It was a world of desire and denial. Mrs. Jefferson's father had fathered with Sally Hemings's mother had had Sally. So endless complications. But the moral conclusion is pretty straightforward, which is that all of our sensibilities lead us to think that this just could not stand. It's repugnant to us. And it was repugnant to enough people then that we had the beginnings of the anti-slavery movement. One thing I think about the moral utility of history is, having said everything I've just said about Jefferson and his failings, Arthur Schlesinger used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. That it's easy for us to wag our finger and render judgment retrospectively on the past, when it seems to me that, and I'll let Arthur off the hook at this point, this is me now, that one use of exploring the past and the failings of earlier generations is not to make ourselves feel better in a false way, not to create a kind of moral antidepressant out of it, but to raise and sharpen our own moral antenna about the problems of our own time. If one generation's unacknowledged evil, totally accepted practice, is another generation's clear evil, then presumably we are living at this hour with a similar set of issues. I leave it to you to figure out what that might be. I think that climate change is something that ultimately may be seen as a morally and scientifically clear issue that was ignored for a long time for reasons of the convenience of the stakeholders in the status quo. That's a lot like the slavery debate in the United States. And so I would just urge us, as we think about these things, as we talk about these things, to keep that in mind. So, best of us, worst of us. An early 19th century biographer of Jefferson once said that if Jefferson is wrong, then America is wrong. And if Jefferson is right, then America is right. Now, that's a hell of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about Hamilton. You don't hear that about Adams. You don't hear that about Washington. You don't hear that about Franklin. You don't hear that about Madison. But you do hear it about Jefferson. And I think it's because of these two things, the best of us and the worst of us. And I think that that's why he resonates. That's why he's the one founder I can imagine having a drink with. I cannot imagine drinking with John Adams. It's a little like what Lionel Trilling said about Fanny in Mansfield Park. An evening with John Adams would not be undertaken lightly. Jefferson speaks to us, I think, because in a very distant mirror, I think intuitively, consciously, or subconsciously, we see ourselves. We see that we're capable of great good, but also are willing often to live with evil and to make sacrifices and compromises that in the bright light of day we would not be totally proud of. I want to leave you with a couple of points about Jefferson's political style, given where we are in the news today with the fiscal cliff and everything else. There are three things I think that current presidents can learn from how Jefferson operated in the 40 years he was in office. One is Jefferson, after a very poor run as the wartime governor of Virginia during the Revolution, promised in what I think of as a Scarlett O'Hara moment that he would never be hungry again. He was never going to be caught flat-footed again. And so he was very quick after 1780, 81, 82 to seize the initiative. He understood and would understand that in a second term, the president's clock is in a kind of tragic discontinuity with everybody else's clock. Everybody else has another election. Everybody else in the system, except the president. And so the president's political capital drops like this as the days go by. His vision gets wider because he's faced his last election. At just the moment, everyone else in the system's vision gets smaller because they have to get through the next race. And so my own private hope is that whatever deal can be gotten this month, right now, out of Capitol Hill is a good thing. That historically speaking, Obama has much more leverage today than he would even in February. Historically, I think that's true. The ability to depart from dogma to, as Jefferson put it, the ground of liberty is gained by inches. It is best to give as well as to take in a system such as ours. Don't compromise the central principle. For him, it was the existence of the country. But find that principle and then take the deal you can get and work on it again tomorrow. The other is, and something that I think by fairly common assent the president has not been terrifically good at, is actually bringing members of Congress closer inside the tent. Just have them to dinner. Have them to lunch. Bowl with them. He plays a lot of golf. Play golf with them. I wouldn't want to do it, but I didn't run for president twice. You asked for the job. And so what Jefferson did is roughly every night when Congress was in session, he had lawmakers to dinner. All Republicans one night and all Federalists the next. All Republicans, all Federalists. Because he didn't want to preside over some kind of faux kumbaya moment. What he wanted to do was find a way for the lawmakers to feel an attachment to him. Because as president, he believed he was the center of the story. He would never have admitted that, but that's what he thought, and to weave those attachments. There's a wonderful example of this. In 1803, a New Hampshire Federalist came down to serve in the Senate, believing that Jefferson was, in fact, the devil. And by 1809, when Jefferson leaves Washington a week after Madison's inauguration, he and this senator are exchanging pecan recipes. So it created a climate, it helped create a climate in which compromise was possible. And life is on the margins. The middle way is not always the right way. I'm not arguing that by any means. But 7 times out of 10, it probably is. And our political experience, our history tells us that that's the case. And Jefferson's career tells us that that's the case. The last thing is, Jefferson created a politics of optimism that, and I mentioned this briefly before, a politics of optimism in which he was able to conjure a picture of what the country should be, arguing that present pain was worth the sacrifice because it was an investment, not simply pain for pain's sake. I firmly believe that every great American leader since then has mastered that vernacular, and that was Jefferson's vernacular. He did it because he believed not only in political progress, but, to bring us full circle, in human progress. He believed that our best days were ahead because in his own lifetime, he'd seen that unfold. In his intellectual lifetime, he had seen that the individual mind, the individual heart, had achieved a level of liberty unknown in human history. So he had lived this. This progress wasn't an abstraction to him. He was born the subject of a king and died the president of a country that had not existed when he was born, believing that that country was in fact full of the promise that would ultimately be fulfilled, that all men were created equal. He didn't fulfill it, but he set in motion a chain of events that has led all of us to this hour. Not bad, that. I want to give Lincoln the last word because he had such a good box office week. Here's Abraham Lincoln on Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence and all men are created equal, 1859. Abraham Lincoln. All honor to Jefferson, to the man who in the concrete pressure of a struggle for national independence had the coolness, forecast, and capacity. I love that. The coolness, forecast, and capacity to introduce into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth applicable to all men and all times, that today and in all coming days it shall be a rebuke and stumbling block to the very signs of reappearing tyranny and oppression. Not a bad legacy. Thank you very much. If I don't like the questions, I have the means.
For those of you in our radio listening audience, we're discussing the gavel of the Commonwealth Club. Thank you, John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, author now of a new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, a social and political commentator, as an editor and a journalist. We have a host of questions for you, Mr. Meacham. Many of them about Jefferson and your book, but some about current politics and some about you. So we'll start with the with Thomas Jefferson.
I think he's earned it.
Okay. Why did you decide to write a book about Thomas Jefferson? There's been a host of scholarly work done about Jefferson over the decades.
I was misinformed.
Okay.
4 years ago, when I was discussing Andrew Jackson, my fellow Tennessean, who, by the way, was much easier to write about because whenever he got mad, he shot someone, which is much easier to dramatize than writing a letter. So there were moments in Andrew Jackson's life that were rather like Bonanza meets Advise and Consent. You know, it was a tough time. These were the weeks. It was published on the 11th of November, Armistice Day, right after President Obama had become President-elect Obama. And there was something about this tall, cool, cerebral man, a politician writer, who seemed to be highly ambivalent about politics while being self-evidently awfully good at them. And Obama intrigued me in that way. And so I was just, while I was flying around the country, frankly, I was just thinking, is there any other person? And yes, Jefferson. Jefferson on the tombstone, most, you know, the great historical jeopardy question. What are the three achievements on Thomas Jefferson's tombstone? Author of the Declaration of Independence, author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, founder of the University of Virginia. It's one of the great acts of misdirection in American history because it sent us off away from his political career, away from what he'd done for 40 years, into the realm of ideas, where you talk about equality, you talk about liberty of conscience, you talk about enlightenment. Hard to get a caucus up against those things, right? So, as the psychiatrists tell us, what you don't mention is often the most important. And so, as I sort of pulled the string back, it occurred to me that Jefferson's political career was hiding in plain sight. He didn't want to talk about it, but it had been the work of his days, again and again. You know, we always talked about, oh, I want to go back to Monticello, to my gardens, and the road was open. You know, he could have done it. He didn't. He was irresistibly drawn to politics. And I wanted to explore that Jefferson.
Thank you. What was the most surprising thing you learned when you researched and wrote this book?
I was surprised by Jefferson's self-awareness of the size of his appetites. That is, one of his first letters is about sex. It's from his college days. He's talking about, he's quoting St. Paul, making jokes about it. People who had argued against the Hemings connection had often pointed to Jefferson as too clinical a man to ever have done something like that, that he lived in his mind, that he was a man, that he was the tombstone. They followed the tombstone. I was on page 4 of the letters, and there he is, you know, running around bars in Williamsburg. And so I just can't believe, his wife died when he was 40. I just can't believe that a man with limitless appetites for power, wine, women, song, art, architecture, gardening, agriculture, books, on and on and on, would stop somehow magically short of the most sensuous human activity we know. And I think he knew that. And I think seeing him more honestly, frankly, by his own testimony was genuinely surprising to me.
Thank you. We'll get back to that a little bit later, but there are a number of questions. Let me paraphrase them. You describe Jefferson as a dreamer and a pragmatist.
That's Alexander Hamilton coming to get you.
I understand that.
He doesn't like all this airtime for Jefferson.
As a dreamer and a pragmatist, what about Jefferson would be most applicable to today? You've touched on that, but would you mind expounding?
I think he was a principled pragmatist, and I think our best presidents have been principled pragmatists. Again, I don't want to elevate compromise as some kind of end in and of itself. The American experience with slavery and race and civil rights shows that there are moments where ideological purity and courage are absolutely the right way to go. And so sometimes the base is right. But what Jefferson represented again and again on issue after issue, from being a member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia, being on a dozen committees or so and as a member of the Continental Congress, the Declaration of Independence was one of about 6 things he was doing that summer. If you want to know everything you ever wanted to know and more about the proposed defense of Canada, read the Jefferson Papers. He was in charge of that. They are endless. Anything, it's a little like the old New Republic. The New Republic had a contest for the most boring headline ever written, and the winner was Worthwhile Canadian Initiative. Very similar to that. But he worked and worked and worked, and as I say, anything short of the existence of the country, he was willing to look at. And I think we could use on both sides a sense that you cannot always be ideologically 100% pure. And I think the Republican Party, to be nationally competitive in a better and stronger way, needs to go through the kind of process that the Democratic Party went through after Vice President Mondale lost in 1984, which was the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, the rise of Bill Clinton and Al Gore, a kind of at least changing the vernacular in which one talked about issues. And my sense is that, as I've been saying, you know, Grover Norquist may turn out to be the Republican sister soldier. And it may just be that they have to take on that ideological test to break free of it.
Thank you. This questioner believes that you know Joseph Ellis, who wrote a volume on Jefferson in the 1990s that basically stated that Jefferson was scheming and a paranoid anti-monarchist. First of all, do you know Joseph Ellis? And second, did you ever discuss this with him? And if you haven't, how do you feel about that comment?
I know Joe. He's a friend and wonderful historian, and we disagree about this. I think scheming politician is redundant, first of all. We start there. And as President Nixon proved, even paranoids have enemies. So,
all right, thank you. By the time he finished as president, had Jefferson become almost like Hamilton in his views of the American government?
Pretty damn near, yep. Jefferson was a small government Republican until he was in charge of big government. And then he thought it was absolutely fine to do that, which tends to happen, right? I mean, federal spending went up under Ronald Reagan. Bill Clinton declared the era of big government over. You know, circumstances take people to places they did not expect to go in politics. If you want philosophical consistency, politics is not the place to be. Perhaps the academy is, but it's not. Consistency is the first casualty in politics, and I think that's simply the truth. My argument in the book is that he used Hamiltonian means to achieve Jeffersonian ends. That is, in centrally Louisiana, which is so important, he got Louisiana by Hamiltonian means, but he wanted it to be an addition to and a bulwark and key part of the Republican experiment. He believed that space and geography mattered enormously politically because it would be harder for factions to form. He and Madison were very good on this. And so he saw a very clear political implication to the addition of Louisiana that would help keep the virtues, the Republican virtues, lowercase r, that he believed so strongly in growing and thriving in the United States.
Thank you. To those of you who are listening to us on the radio or the internet, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest tonight is John Meacham, the Pulitzer Prize winning author, who is discussing his latest book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Art of Power. Annette Gordon-Reed, if I remember correctly her name, in her work, The Hemings of Monticello, pretty much describes Jefferson as a hypocrite. You've discussed his views about slavery and his pragmatic views there. How do you feel about taking the characterization of Jefferson that far?
I think he was a hypocrite. He was also a human being. And I think there's a thin line between those two. Let me say something about Annette Gordon-Reed, who is one of the most formidable scholars at work today. Annette is very annoying. She's the most decorated historian of our time. She has won the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, the National Humanities Medal. She's a professor of law at Harvard, and she's really, really nice. And it really just drives me crazy. Because you want her to be mean. She's an incredibly generous scholar and colleague, and almost single-handedly reopened the Hemings question with a book in the late 1990s, before the DNA testing, that revisited the Hemings question and argued for Jefferson's paternity of those children. The Hemingses of Monticello is a fabulous book. It's the book for which she won the prize, the Pulitzer Prize. Oh, she's also won the MacArthur Genius thing. That's another reason I'm mad at her. So it's a very important book, and if you're interested in all of this, please, please read it. Yes, he's a hypocrite. I don't think there's any getting around it. But the question is, once you label him that, what do you do with it? And my view is you try to understand it in human terms, not in order to excuse him or canonize him or clean him up for posterity, but to see him in an honest, real light. And to me, that's the point of this whole exercise.
This questioner is interested in the fact that Sally Hemings seems to float in and out of the pages of your book, but you really don't do an in-depth analysis of her and her involvement with Jefferson. How do you react to that criticism?
I welcome it. I'm just kidding. Like all writers, I enjoy criticism. I don't know that I agree, and let me tell you why. My treatment of Hemings went as far as the known evidence and textual documents could take us. I did not speculate on the nature of the relationship except to raise the question, was there emotional content to it? Was it institutionalized rape? Was it a pragmatic arrangement between the two? Was it some of these things at different times over their 40 years together? There are no known images of her. There are two physical descriptions. And so, yeah, if you're looking for a dramatic account of Hemings herself, you're going to have to go to a novel because we don't have the evidence. We don't have it. And I believe very strongly that the paternity question is put to rest. I think that, as I said, perhaps the longest sustained treatment is the Paris moment, where I was just so struck by her courage and her ability to make something out of nothing, the nothing that fate had given her. And so I stand by my treatment.
Thank you. There are a few odd and end questions. Let me try to put them together and paraphrase them. About Sally Hemings and Jefferson, there are still some people that question whether or not he truly did sire children. Would you comment on the DNA study that was done?
Sure. Yeah, they're also flat earthers. And I think...
they're birthers.
Then they're birthers, yeah. I will say this, two things. I did not find Thomas Jefferson's birth certificate, so. The other thing that's very important is I, at no time, had an inappropriate relationship with Thomas Jefferson. I want that to be very clear. I'm writing a book about George Herbert Walker Bush, and I sent him an email when the Petraeus story broke saying, no way, man. I think that's what put him in the hospital, actually. Even the thought of it. I think that... What's the question again? I'm sorry.
The DNA evidence.
Oh, DNA, sorry, DNA. Sorry, I was wandering around. It's like Reagan in the first debate in 84. Remember the Pacific Coast Highway? So it was reopened. Let's go back. Let's go to the beginning. 1802. James Thompson Callender, a Scottish-born newspaperman, long in the pay of Jefferson as a propagandist who attacked John Adams on Jefferson's behalf, is disenchanted with Jefferson because he is not fully refunded the fine that he had to pay under John Adams' Sedition Act when he was prosecuted and convicted. Callender did not believe neither a pardon nor the refund of the fine came quickly enough. He turns on Jefferson and publishes in September 1802 a pretty damn accurate account of what we know about the Heming story. That was 210 years and 2 months ago. This has been in circulation for a long time. There were editorial cartoons, there's one in the book, of Jefferson's head on a rooster with a line, a philosophic cock. He was attacked for Dusky Sal, was the way the Federalist newspapers talked about her. He was basically called a predator, and John Adams himself said privately of the story that it was the inevitable result of that foul contagion known as Negro slavery, because it was so common in the slaveholding South. So this has been around. And for a long time, two centuries really, mainstream white historians denied the paternity story, by and large. They had different reasons for doing it. They had different arguments. But Joseph Ellis before the DNA testing, Merrill Peterson, Duma Malone, I mean, great, great historians just said no. Along comes Fawn Brody in the early 1970s, writes a very good book called Jefferson, An Intimate Portrait, raising all these questions anew. The fact that Jefferson was always at Monticello, where Hemings was, 9.5 to 10 months before she gave birth, every time. And she never gave birth any other time. Raising the fact that there were people at Jefferson's dinner table who would be physically shocked by the resemblance of slaves serving the table to their master. So the Jefferson white apologists, if you will, say, oh, well, it wasn't Jefferson, it was his nephews, Samuel and Peter Carr. They were dragged into this. Well, along comes Annette Gordon-Reed in the mid-1990s, revisits the Brody scholarship, visits all the scholarship, finds that, guess what, it's really, really compelling evidence. And so they're able to do DNA testing. They establish, you know, it's a 99.9%, whatever the CSI thing is, percentage, right, that Jefferson is the father. Or let me put it this way, a male Jefferson is the father. So that takes care of Samuel and Peter Carr. Remember, they were brought in as the fall guys. So now there has to be somebody else. So they find Randolph Jefferson. No one in two centuries had suggested that Randolph Jefferson, who lived 100 miles away, was the father of these children until the DNA testing made it. They had to find somebody. So it's just, you know, at some point, you look at the evidence and, you know, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And I believe that this is true. I believe it's even absent the DNA evidence, I would believe is true. I think I would come down on that side because there's African-American oral history of equal value, of equal evidentiary value that says this happened. Why do we deny it? Because the white family says it didn't happen. Oral history versus oral history. So you tell me in an evidentiary way why you privileged the white oral history over the black oral history.
Thank you. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on the same day. Is it fact or fiction or myth that they both said about each other, thank goodness John Adams still lives? And Adams said, thank goodness Thomas Jefferson is still with us.
Tragically for John Adams, Thomas Jefferson did not say that. We have it from one of Adams's daughters-in-law, I believe is, that Adams did say either Jefferson survives or Thomas Jefferson lives. It was something like that. Jefferson had died 8 hours before, but the point remains. It's one of the sweeter moments in the whole story, I think. First of all, boy, talk about knowing how to make an exit. These two guys, Lord Almighty. Harry Truman once said, heroes always know when to die. You know, if you're Lincoln and you're going to get shot, Good Friday's a good day. You know, if you're Jefferson and Adams and you're going to die, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. John Quincy Adams, who was president, said, it is a mark of divine providence. There was this huge, it was an enormous national moment of mythology and legend, of the apotheosis of the founders. I think it was the first moment of founder's chic, actually, where people were looking back from the James Monroe, John Quincy Adams. There'd been a very rough presidential election in 1824. Andrew Jackson won the popular vote but lost in the House. Tennesseans have a hard time with the Electoral College, as you all may know. And so there was a moment of division, and looking back at this moment of seeming unity with the death of these two great men was a kind of national catharsis, which I think is one of the first moments of a shared national experience in the way the Kennedy assassination would be years later.
Thank you. For those of you who are listening, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest today is John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and whose latest book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. There are a host of questions about politics today. We don't have enough time for many of them. I'm going to select a couple. Do you believe the Republican Party is still going to maintain its conservative trend in the sense that there will be Tea Party folks running for office and those elected representatives will have to move to the right in order to keep their seats?
One of the most fascinating conversations I had in the past 5 years was with a border state Republican member of Congress who was seeking statewide office. Who I asked him, he'd been in the House for maybe 15, 20 years. And I said, have things changed? Everyone says it's gotten worse, has it? And he said, yes. And the reason is, we used to worry about the general election. Now, because of the redistricting and because of technology has just sort of made these districts so pure one way or the other, the worry is not whether a Democrat's going to run against us, it's whether we're going to get primaried. And I'd never heard it used as a verb. But the fear of being primaried, of having someone from the more ideologically pure part of your party run against you and take the nomination away, Dick Lugar, anyone? I mean, you know, it's happened, is a driving force. And so I believe, as I said a second ago, I think the Republican Party, and I'm sure they welcome my advice, but as an observer, I just think there has to be some kind of rethinking, repositioning. Here's a statistic that if I were a Republican, I would be really intrigued by. The United States of America went from 1944 until 1996 without re-electing a Democratic president. And now we've re-elected two in the last 10 years. That's an interesting statistic. And so what's happening to that post-1968 lock on the Electoral College that the Republicans had? Obama broke it, is what happened. I mean, by taking Virginia and North Carolina and Florida out of the equation. And so it is going to be ever harder for the old Republican coalition to win national elections. But one of the things we learned from Jefferson and we learned from our own political memories is this stuff can move really fast and can turn on a dime. And so I think that's a very, very big question for the Republicans.
Thank you. Why is Bill Clinton still extraordinarily popular? Was he a man of great appetites like Jefferson?
I think anyone who has to ask the second should not be allowed membership in the Commonwealth Club. The standards are falling. My fear about President Clinton is he's still out campaigning. And somebody needs to tell him that we actually voted. I worry sometimes that he's going to become like the Admiral in Mary Poppins and have his own ship on top of a building. But he's got another campaign to run, which is going to be very, very interesting coming up. And I, as the father of daughters, two daughters, I am very eager for Secretary Clinton to run. That's not a partisan statement. I just think the iconography of and the importance in terms of image and aspiration for girls in this country to have Senator Clinton in the race is hugely important. And so I'm all for that. But that doesn't answer the question about appetites. The reason President Clinton is popular is he loves what he does. And what he does is he talks politics and he understands policy. And nobody, I mean, remember, the President of the United States basically subcontracted his reelection. You know, he outsourced his acceptance speech. Remember? It was a hell of a performance. It was a great performance. It made me think if Clinton could have gone to the Senate and defended himself in impeachment, we would have saved a year and a half. So I think that people like politicians who like them. Right? And I think that one of the odd things about American history is we have so many introverts who rise to the top. Nixon, you know, Reagan could only speak before an audience. He was like Johnny Carson. You know, it took a sea of people for him to come alive. Then you have Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, Bill Clinton. You know, they love it. And they're good at it, and I think people appreciate that. They want, and Bill Clinton, if he were here, would be, you know, I'll tell you what. He would be doing it. He would tell you that if people think you're fighting for them, and actually this is what he would do. If people think you're fighting for them, they will fight for you.
Thank you. We have time for just really one or maybe two questions, depending upon the answers. One, how did you write such a fascinating book about Thomas Jefferson while you had a day job at Random House, were raising three children and living in Nashville and working in New York City?
I married well.
All right, that's a great answer. Final question of the evening.
And also, everything I do beats working for a living. I feel so blessed, so fortunate to be able to do what I do. I really do. I think it's remarkable. If you had told me 20 years ago that I could write books about dead people and people would care and want to talk about them, I would have said, life can't be that great. So, and I'm enormously, for 1 second, I'm enormously appreciative of your presence here and your interest in these subjects. For people like me, it's a rough time as the digital revolution runs its course. No one's sure where this is going in terms of storytelling and historical research and the news. You know, it's a very discombobulating hour in a lot of the worlds I'm part of. And your presence and interest means the world, so thank you.
All right, I'm going to ask one last question. I'm not sure we're on the radio any longer or not, but let's do it anyway. What's it like being a guest on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart?
It's terrifying. He's always incredibly kind to me, so I'm not as terrified, which may be the way he wants it. You know, he's one of the best prepared interviewers I've ever seen. He totally knows what you're doing. He knows the subject cold, and he knows when you're bullshitting. And that's, when you think about it, that's chief what he and Colbert do. And it's remarkable when you think about it. They're kind of the Edward R. Murrows of the hour, right? I mean, they're the ones who hold people to account, and they can do it because they're who they are. But it's a remarkable story in the course of American journalism that we've gone from Murrow and the Muckrakers, McClure's magazine, all of that, Ida Tarbell, to where a place where two brilliant political satirists are really the chief accountants in the American political system. So God bless them.
Thank you, Jon Stewart. Our thanks to John Meacham.
Our thanks to John Meacham, author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Joseph Fink, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.